All right, so we're continuing on. Yao, 2012, a beautiful sunny summer, Australia. Mike Lee, man.
It's good to see you again, man.
Nice to see you. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Been busy.
Yeah, I bet. So we talked last year at Yao.
Yep.
Excellent conversation, so I'm stoked you're back this year. So what have you been up to in the last year?
Well, you know, last time I was here, we were talking about Amsterdam,
yes.
Of course, right? I was running that, and that's been going really great. Right about mid-year last year, decided after doing it for a year that it was time to turn it over to the community so it could really be something that was owned and operated by itself, you know?
Awesome.
Decided to, you know, actually leverage the ecosystem, actually do the stuff that we've been telling people to do, which is to start companies in this ecosystem. So the first company we started was a little games company called The New Lemurs. And we're really into this notion of not so much making educational games, but making games educational.
Okay, excellent, man. And you just released that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Our first game is Lemurs Chemistry Water. You know, it has to do with lemurs, chemistry, and water, so we thought it was a pretty good game. And it's a game about chemistry.
Nice.
Right?
Yeah.
And so the whole idea is, it doesn't look like it's about chemistry. It just looks like a regular game. You know, it's just a little action puzzle game. There's lots going on. But, you know, these little red ones here, these are actually oxygen. These little white ones here, these are actually hydrogen. Mm. And you can actually combine them and form water.
Nice.
And, you know, you water the plants and the plants grow and, you know, all of the things that you expect from a game. But the thing is, this little game is actually based on absolute top-notch science. And so if you learn to play the game, you're actually learning science. It doesn't feel like you're learning science, but you are.
Nice.
The whole idea here is that every game is basically a series of things that you're learning. There's a system. You learn the system. You're challenged. You overcome the challenge. You get a little dopamine rush, and that's what we call fun.
Cool.
But these systems, they're always arbitrary. They're made up by the game maker for the sake of making it easy to make a game. But if you replace the arbitrary system with a natural system, such as chemistry, then you have a set of rules, just like any game. The difference is that as you master the system, you're actually learning something useful. The metaphor that I use is this idea of nutritious and delicious, right? Where when you talk about food, you have food that is delicious and cheap and easy to get, but bad for you. And then you have food that's good for you, but it's not really good and it's expensive and, you know, it's not distributed the way that fast food is distributed.
Yeah.
And so people are fat and unhappy. Mm. But if you could somehow make food that was actually the most delicious food, the cheapest and easiest food to get, and it also happened to be the most nutritious food, everybody would be healthy.
Mm.
With games, it's the same way. I love games, you know. I've been playing games. My first job was selling video games. You know, they say 10,000 hours makes you an expert or something. Well, I easily played 100,000 hours of video games. I love them, but they're like junk food. They're fun, but they're not good for you. And I feel like I'm wasting my time when I play them.
Hmm.
With a game like this, you can just have fun, but you're not wasting your time. It's nutritious and delicious.
Awesome, man. So let's talk a little bit about, because you're not a chemist, but you like chemistry.
Right.
And so you, of course, had to, you know, build the chemistry library and stuff like this. Talk to me about how you made this, like, real.
It's actually a really interesting story. So the first thing that happened was, you know, I met a bunch of great people last year at Yao, and one of the guys I met was this guy, Ben Hogan, right? Awesome guy. He came to Amsterdam, and we were hanging out, and he happened to run into this chemist at some random tech event.
Mm.
So he introduces me to the chemist, this great guy, Anthony England, got his PhD from MIT, like, real serious chemist, right?
Okay.
So we started talking to him about this, and what I really wanted to do was just a real simple reaction, the combustion of hydrogen and air to make water. How hard could that be? But what does that actually look like? If you blow the molecules up, you know, billions of times so you can actually touch them and manipulate them, well, chemistry should be easy to learn, but what does it actually look like? Well, it turns out, like, when I was in high school, we didn't really know. But now, in the past 5 years, that research has been done. So there's a whole bunch of scientific literature papers that have been published on the subject. He goes through the papers, he finds all of the good papers, he sends them to us. So we go through the papers, take the science, port that to Objective-C, as I like to say, and then, you know, had our little chemistry engine going. Well, the funny thing was, when we actually sent that back to him and he started, you know, seeing the model that we had built, he came back and said, oh no, this is wrong. You've made some mistakes.
Hmm.
And so we went back and we checked the state tables and those were okay. And so then we went back and we checked the equations and those all lined up. And so I sent it back and I'm like, dude, everything lines up. And then he comes back and says, oh, there's a problem in the science. It turned out that somebody somewhere along the line had made a mistake somewhere, misquoted the original research, and then through citation and citation, that sort of error had just propagated through. So what we ended up having to do was contact the original authors of the papers, these guys at the Princeton Combustion Lab, get the most up-to-date science and verify our model with them. So what we ended up with was a cute little $2 kids game that happens to be the most accurate model of hydrogen combustion in the world. Which really came to bear because when we started telling people about this stuff, this guy, Stuart Cantrell, he's the editor-in-chief of Nature Chemistry, the peer-reviewed journal. He finds out about the game and he tweets, you know, weird chemistry game with some dodgy science. You know, kind of parentheses dodgy. And so I responded to him and I'm like, dodgy? We have an MIT-trained chemist as our advisor and we verified our model with the Princeton Combustion Lab. To which he responded, well, that's what I expect from any iOS developer. But I thought it was a great, I thought it was a great comeback.
Totally. Right? Yeah. Excellent, man. So, this is New Lemurs, of course, as you mentioned, is the game company.
Yeah.
And you guys are going to continue to make educational games. And one of the things I'm kind of curious, since this is sort of your introduction to chemistry, you know, water is kind of the basic. Are you going to, how are you going to evolve this game? Is it going to get more advanced? At some point, you're going to have an organic chemistry game?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, when you think of the, again, lemurs, chemistry, water, right? Each one of those things is really kind of a pathway into new things. Lemurs, chemistry, water itself, there's a lot more about water that we can tell. Again, this is just real basic stuff. You know, we'd love to get carbon involved at some point. You know, there's a carbon dioxide, oxygen cycle. There's some plants in here, so we can talk a little bit about, you know, these sort of very simple natural systems that maybe you can experience in everyday life, but you can actually see what that looks like on the atomic level, right? But then lemurs chemistry itself, there's a lot of other chemistries that we can explore. This is just one game about chemistry. Chemistry is a big, complicated topic. There are a lot of games to be made about chemistry. You know, imagine lemurs chemistry metal, lemurs chemistry carbon, lemurs chemistry nitro. That's one that I'm really looking forward to, right? But then chemistry is, again, only one topic. You know, there's games that we want to make about dinosaurs. There's games that we want to make about component electronics. I mean, the whole universe of knowledge is basically just raw material ripe to be mined in the gaming industry. And the other thing is we can't do it all ourselves. My big thing with this is if I can prove that you can make a game that's both educational and fun and also makes money, well, then all of a sudden there's going to be tons of competitors. Everyone is going to be making games like this. And I love that because it's not for me about just making the most money and, you know, controlling the new educational games market. It's about showing people how this stuff can be done. If a year from now, 2 years from now, everyone is following the new Lemurs way of doing things instead of the Zynga way of doing things, I just think that the world's going to be a better place.
Awesome, man. Now, you've also been, last time I saw you in Amsterdam, you have also been working on something you call the transdimensional portal.
Ah, the portal.
Now that sounds cool. What is that?
So the transdimensional portal basically is an advanced audio system, right? And you know, when I say an advanced audio system, you might think, oh, it's like a fancy stereo. But it turns out that once we can get away from the stereo way of doing things, there's an entire evolution of audio that can happen. And this has effects all over everything, right? For one thing, object-oriented audio, the way that I had to do the audio for this game, and the way that audio is done for games as far as I understand. First, you know, the graphics have to happen, and that happens in XYZ space, you know, three-dimensional space with physics. And then I have to go through and add sound to the game, and I have to describe those sounds in terms of pan and fade, which are really stereo hardware things, right? So not only do I have to do everything twice, but I have to do everything twice, and one of those ways is tied to the rendering pipeline of the hardware, which doesn't make any sense, right? So with an object-oriented sound system, you don't do that. You just say, yeah, X, Y, Z. This is an explosion. As for the physics of it, there's a physics engine. Let the computer do the math. You know, I'm a firm believer in that. And then when it comes time to render this stuff out, you can render it to stereo, you can render it to surround sound, or you can render it to a higher order ambisonic system. And that's what the transdimensional portal really is. Because, you know, the way that audio works now, you have these really, you know, potentially very expensive fancy speakers, and they're all sort of creating an independent channel of sound. And then you kind of sit in the middle and all these independent channels of sound kind of combine roughly to form a, you know, a sweet spot, if you will.
Okay.
Ambisonic systems are fundamentally different. What you have instead are pairs of opposing speakers that work cooperatively, creating sine waves, which can then interfere with each other. And by the law of sine waves, create any wave. And so what you create then is a sound field where you have these kind of audio pixels, right? And you can have a zeroth order system where you have two sets of opposed speakers on one plane. Then you can take three of those planes with 12 speakers. They don't have to be terribly expensive. What's important is the geometry and the computers that run the whole thing. And then you create a sound field, right? And you get a holophonic sound experience. It's like the audio component of the holodeck, which is really interesting from sort of a, you know, 3D sound perspective, and you get height and stuff like that. It's the best 3D sound system you've ever heard.
Nice.
But that turns out to be the least interesting thing about it, because it turns out that when you move to this higher order of sound, you start to get these really interesting effects on the brain, right? Effects that can actually be measured with biotelemetry, right? We can hook up heart monitors and brain monitors and actually monitor your body's response to sound. It turns out that a full quarter of our brain is dedicated to the processing of sound. Anyone who's a fan of music, and that's pretty much everyone, knows that music is a drug. The transdimensional portal is like a hypodermic needle for music. The first time I got into this thing, I listened to a song, and just listening to that song, it was like a command prompt opened up in my brain. And I did what felt like 24 hours of thinking in just 5 minutes. And just the stimulation of creativity. And when I got out of it, it was like, you know, I was like stumbling around like something had happened to me, you know? And so I told these guys, I have to bring you to Amsterdam. I have to get you to set up one of these systems. And so we brought them in this beautiful building in the center of Amsterdam, the Vach building, you know, it's like a little castle in the center of town. And there's a technology fabrication laboratory there that's open to the public. And so we built this machine here so producers can come and, you know, actually produce content for it.
Nice.
And it's really funny because, of course, you know, when I experienced it the first time, I was in San Francisco for WWDC, and that whole week is such a big, exciting time. It's like being in an altered state just from that, just being surrounded by cool people, just like being here at Yao, you know. You're going to experience something, and you're going to say, wow, that was great. But when you actually get into it, maybe it wasn't great. And so I was really nervous about it, right, because I'm telling everybody about it, and then they finally build the thing. They bring it online. They haven't really configured it yet. I get a demo, and it's like, yeah, this sounds like a good sound system, but that's not what it's meant to be. It's meant to be more than that. And I was kind of like, oh no, oh no. And then the next day when they had actually configured it properly, I went for the demo. Immediately I could tell that something was right. There was, it was popping somehow, right? It's just the sounds were just cleanly separated. But then they played the theme from Jaws, you know, John Williams.
Yes.
When I hear that, I laugh, right? It's corny. But in the ambisonic system, it affected me. Like, it affected me. It was like I was having a panic attack. My heart started to beat. My chest got tight. I felt very, very tense. And I started to laugh because the machine worked. And it didn't just work. It was better than the theater. Can you imagine a home sound system that is better than the theater?
Nice.
That's what this enables. And again, you know, it's my kind of company, right? I think that this stuff is important, not because it's cool. Not because it's cool. I'm not in the business of doing things that are cool. I'm in the business of doing things that are cool because they're going to change the world, because they're going to help us evolve as a species. I think that this machine is the closest thing we have to that machine from The Matrix that teaches you kung fu. I think it's going to have incredible effects in educational content, because again, think of this chemistry game, right? This is 1.0 of chemistry. It's flat. It's on the iPad. But imagine version 7, where molecules are just floating, right? And imagine taking that and applying it to everything. What if all of the knowledge of the world could be scaled up or down, slowed or sped up to the scale of human experience? So that just like Lemur's chemistry enables you to touch molecules, everything in the world like this, absolute immersion. The audio is 80% of it. A lot of other people are working on the visuals. By the time you and I are old men, well, older than we are now, you know, our kids, our grandkids, they're going to have this completely immersive experience. They're going to be able to know things and go places anywhere in space and time. And that's why we call it the transdimensional portal, right? Because it really takes you places. Because of that, you know, this thing is $2, right? This game, right? It could be more. I could explore exotic monetization. I could have in-app purchases, you know, but I don't want to do that stuff, right? Because I think that this is important for people to have. And I'm just going to, you know, charge an honest price, just get it out there. Same thing with the portal. Imagine an audio company that A, uses science instead of pseudoscience, and B, is more interested in getting the equipment into your house than they are in just making ludicrous profits, right? We're not going to charge $3,000 for a cable. We're going to get you this thing as cheaply as we can get you this thing because we want you to have it because it's going to change everything.
Awesome. And I mean, in some sense, I'm assuming you're going to make it programmable.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it's a platform play. That means that there's going to be content, right? Mm-hmm. Which means that once again, just like this, what I'm doing is interesting, but what other people are going to do, that's what's really interesting.
Right on, man. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about, you know, this is an engineering conference, it's a software developers conference. You've done a couple keynotes, which have been really, really interesting, and sort of the theme, you know, one of the themes that sort of stuck with me was the notion of, you know, fear. Mm. And the impact that fear has on development, yeah, software engineering.
Yeah.
So can you talk about that?
Yeah. I mean, you know, if you know anything about my history, I've had quite a relationship with fear. You know, I was much younger. I was almost murdered by a carjacker, and I had post-traumatic stress disorder. And, you know, the company wouldn't pay for treatment, and I didn't have support from my family. And I ended up having to just sort of live that way for quite some time. Hmm. And that was a life utterly dominated by fear, right? I was afraid of cars. Can you imagine being an American and being afraid of cars? I couldn't leave the house during the day. I couldn't walk on roads. I had to, you know, sneak through people's backyards to go to the store to get food. And if a car came, I was terrified. I would hide. And so I came to not tolerate fear in myself, right? Like the book 1984, this is what the book is about. It's about fear. If you have fear, that fear can be used to control you, you know? And so all my life since then, like when I worked for the airline, there was a plane crash. I developed a fear of flying. Mm. I went to flight school, right? It's like, you're afraid of snakes. Like, go hang out with snakes, you know? Confront that stuff. And the thing is, in software development, fear is all around us, right? Fear of doing the easy, safe thing and not putting yourselves out there, not really trying to move the technology forward, but trying to do things that have already been done. You know, to come up with a truly new idea, to come up with a truly new way of doing things, it's terrifying. Right? Not just because it's not been proven, not just because failure is a real possibility, but because in order to do that, you have to be honest with yourself and with each other. You have to look at what your real abilities are, not who you want to be, but who you truly are. And that is terrifying to most people, absolutely terrifying to most people. And unless you're able to overcome that fear, unless you're able to put fear utterly out of your mind, well, it'll kill you.
Interesting.
It'll kill your company. Hmm.
So, you know, that's, I mean, absolutely correct, and especially, you know, like you said, you know, the notion of don't be afraid to be creative, right? Hmm. I mean, in some sense, what I see is a world where developers get comfortable with a specific set of tools,
oh, yeah,
a specific way of thinking, and when they're asked to leave that box, fear is the first thing you experience, right? Like, I don't know how to program in this language.
Yeah.
It's completely foreign to me.
Yeah.
So we tend to come back into our box and we're just like, I'm a this developer,
mm-hmm,
and I'm sticking with this.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, how do you get out of that? Like, what's some strategies for developers to play around with different ways of, different tools to increase their toolbox without fear of loss of what they've invested the past 10 or 20 years in, like they're finally expert at, say, Objective-C in your case, or they're expert at C++ or C#, or Java or Python or Ruby or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's an interesting thing would be strategies that to help you explore new tools in a comfortable way without like jumping into the fire. Is that possible?
I think it absolutely is. And I mean, I think you've hit on something here, right? Which is that we respect experts, right? I mean, people come to this conference to hear from experts, right? And if you finally find yourself in the position of being an expert, well, then you're an expert, right? But to go to another technology where you don't know what's going on is to go back to not being an expert and to lose that respect, right? There's a couple of strategies for dealing with this. I mean, first and foremost, it's a question of ego, ultimately. Right? I mean, we all like to pretend that we have no ego, but the reality is you're separated from the everything. That is ego by definition, right? I mean, ego just means self. Are you a self? Of course you're a self. You have ego. Well, I mean, this is the problem. we're afraid of, we're not going to be an expert anymore. People aren't going to have respect for us, right? Mm. We're going to look stupid, right? We don't want to look stupid because being stupid is death in this industry. And looking stupid is tantamount to being stupid. But you have to get over that fear because that's how you learn. Mm. And if you look at the genuine experts, right? There are very few people who are only skilled in one thing, mm. right? And I think the reason for that is because, like I talk about in my talk, the more memes you have, the more you can see, right? And very rarely are things so linear that you can block out the rest of the world and things will go smoothly. You'll end up getting broadsided by something that you never expected. And so it's almost a kind of false fear, because what you should be afraid of are not the things that you know that you don't know, but the things that you don't know that you don't know. Those are the things that are deadly and scary. Right? Because you can't do anything about them, and you won't even know when they're coming for you. You know, you could be hit and dead, and you didn't even know that something was coming for you. That's the stuff to truly be afraid of. And the only way to protect yourself from that stuff is to learn as much as possible about as many things as possible so that you eliminate those blind spots. So I think that any programmer, any engineer, hell, any designer, you know, anyone who's used to doing this kind of stuff should be able to realize, well, heck, by obsessing with this little problem, I'm missing the bigger problem. And that's exactly what this is. Mm. The other thing is, it comes down to this notion of knocking yourself off kilter, knocking yourself out of your comfort zone. You know, I talk about this in my talk. There's this success-failure cycle where success breeds arrogance and complacency and blindness and causes failure. But failure forces honesty, it forces improvement, and it leads to success. And so I think when you look at a lot of the kind of best entrepreneurs in the world, they break out of that cycle. They prevent the failure part of the cycle by basically knocking themselves out of their comfort zone already, not allowing failure to happen, to force that to happen, not becoming complacent in their success. You know, we use meditation for things like this. We use deprivation for things like this. And we use entheogenic drugs for things like this. This is why, you know, the relationship between, say, LSD and programming has always been there.
Right on. So for those out there, I mean, you know, rock on. We could talk about that a little bit. I mean, in some sense, programming is a drug.
Mm-hmm. And drugs are software.
And drugs are software.
Drugs are software for the brain.
Excellent. Excellent. Yeah. I buy that.
Yeah.
I buy that. Now, what are some of the, when you look at the industry, because of course you're deep involved in the programming industry, man,
yeah.
And what are some of the kind of problems you see that are facing the industry at large?
I mean, you know, there's the usual stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, people who allow themselves to be sort of pillarized, people who think that there should be a holy war between languages or tools, or you know, get caught up in fighting about things that really don't matter, not realizing that, you know, we're all in this together. I mean, every programmer has more in common with every other programmer than they do with anybody else, just because you see the world the same way. But honestly, I think that the biggest thing that's threatening the industry and really threatening the world because of our industry is just a fundamental lack of responsibility, right? I mean, we're so afraid of this kind of, you know, this dystopian future of surveillance and drones. And it's like, you know, we fear the future, but how can a technologist fear the future? Because the only reason why there can be surveillance and there can be drones is because technologists are doing that stuff. And I mean, it's easy and wrong to think that there are evil technologists who are making evil technology. I've never met an evil technologist. I've never met somebody who isn't just like me, just going out and trying to do the right thing, or trying to feed their family, or just doing their job. Just doing their job. Like, that is such a dangerous idea. Because systems are typically designed to absolve people of responsibility, because somewhere at the top of that system, that's where the evil stuff is happening. And below that are a lot of people who are just doing their jobs. And I mean, you see this not just in our industry, in every industry. I mean, it's so frustrating when you try to get, you know, customer service satisfaction from some corporation, something goes wrong, and you just run into a lot of people pointing fingers at other people, and no one is responsible anymore. Mm. I'm just doing my job are going to be the last words of humanity. Mm. There is no future except for the future that we as technologists bring. And so we shouldn't fear the future. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't even have to fight the future. We should simply make the future that we want to see. I think a lot of the problem is that people just want to work on cool stuff. They just want to, you know, work on the stuff that they want to work on, and they don't want to think about the effects that that stuff has. Mm. But the reality is, a lot of times, even the best of intentions can have unintentional side effects.
Sure.
I mean, I look at, you know, services like Uber, you know, Uber Taxi. They're a great service. They do an excellent job, and from a, you know, the standpoint of designing a product and a service and executing, flawless, absolutely flawless. But when I was in San Francisco, I really saw, like, things were falling apart. Things were worse than they were when I left 2 years ago. And I think a big part of that problem is because it used to be that if you lived in San Francisco, you were confronted with the just insane inequality there. You know, when you took the transit system, you saw how crazy stuff was. You saw how bad the transit system was. When you walked through the streets, you saw how people were living. Uber allows you to ignore all of that. You know, now all of the rich people are just getting whisked away in black cars from point to point, and everything that's in between is allowed to fall apart. You don't even have to look at it. It's a denial of the problems of society. Mm-hmm. And, you know, let's be real, okay? As complicated and as problematic as, like, San Francisco's problems are, San Francisco also has more technologists than anyone in the world. If they genuinely cared about fixing those problems, that city could be a genuine utopia in a year. I promise you, if all of those smart people really put their heads to fixing that problem would be fixed. Getting homeless people off the street is a much less difficult problem than a lot of the stuff that we're dealing with every day. I've gotten lots of homeless people off the street. I have no idea what a monad is, right? There are a lot of people out there who do know what monads are, and yet they think that getting homeless people off the street is impossible. That's just crap. It's just denial of responsibility. Mm. It's time for us as technologists to take responsibility, not just for technology, but for the world around us, because that's what we're meant to be doing. Engineers are not just a class of people. Engineers are produced by nature as part of nature to fix things that nature cannot fix. We find problems that people have. We solve those problems. And we profit from them. But we're not always solving the biggest problems, the challenging problems, because we're afraid. We're afraid we can't do it, but we can do it, and we have to.
Right on, man. That's true. I want to go a little bit back to this notion of transdimensional portal, just because I think it's cool, and I'm going to check it out next time I'm in Amsterdam, man. Are you going to add the capacity to have sort of holographic images inside of it?
I mean, obviously we'd love to, right?
Okay.
I mean, the thing is that, first of all, people, they put too much emphasis on the visual, right? Because we're so used to seeing things around us and everything's colorful and whatever. But realistically speaking, the brain has a lot more neurons dedicated to sound than it does to sight. Sight is a relatively recent, you know, evolution, as it were. And so people think that, you know, an immersive experience is 80% visual, 20% audio, but we find it's actually the opposite, right? So we're really working on the audio component of it because, like, you know, I can make you hallucinate with sounds, but I can't make you hear sounds with visuals. Maybe somebody else can, but I've never seen it done. You know, so that's why we're concentrating on sound, plus everybody else is doing the visual stuff, right?
Yeah.
Like, I could be trying to develop holograms, except that all of these other people are developing holograms. I mean, you know, we see, you know, holographic Tupac and holographic Will.i.am. I mean, obviously the technology's out there.
Okay.
You know, but the audio technology, the ambisonic stuff, it's really been sort of stuck in the enthusiast stage. I mean, the stuff was invented in the 70s, you know, patented, trademarked, all that stuff expired because they didn't have the computing power necessary to simplify this for the user.
Okay.
You know, so it's a lot like, it's in very much the same state that computers were in the 70s, right? Computers had been around for a couple of decades, but they were way too big and way too complicated for normal people to deal with. And then in the 70s, they made that into something that normal people could use, right? And then right at that time, ambisonics were invented, too big, too complicated. And now enough time has passed that we can make this something that normal people can use. Now, with just the sound alone, you know, combined with just sort of existing, you know, visual stuff, I think that you'll find that we're 80% of the way there. And then as the other, you know, holographic technologies and whatnot are developed, then it's easy enough to just sort of license that and drop it in. I mean, I see a future where you have a kind of turnkey portal, you know, where you can just kind of go anywhere, to the carnival, to the arcade, to the library for that matter, get into the portal and, you know, go on a trip.
Awesome, man. So what's next, Mike?
I mean, bigger, better platforms that will support more and more intelligent content. And I think that that, for me, is kind of the ultimate end of this play. Mm. You know, when television was invented, we thought that it was going to end war. You know, we thought that, you know, this will give us the ability to create things, to educate the world. And it just didn't end up working that way. It ended up working the other way. So now we end up with a bunch of kind of reality shows and garbage. Mm. And that establishment has been going for quite some time, and it's pretty well impossible to change. And so it has to be disrupted, you know? And I don't mean the kind of disruption where you're, you know, breaking the law and bullying governments into compliance. I mean the kind of disruption where, you know, you make something that's so much better for people. Like I said, delicious and nutritious. Right? And I don't think those guys are going to get this. I think that they're too invested in the stuff that they're doing now. And so I think what's going to end up happening is, you know, this new breed of technologists, is these people who are waking up and seeing a world not simply of greed and avarice, but a world where we're all fingers on the same hand and we have to move forward together as a species, or else we're not going to be able to move forward at all. Those are the people who are going to be interested in this stuff, this new generation, mm-hmm. right? The people who are thinking in the long term, who are thinking of the greater good in addition to themselves. True capitalism, right? True capitalism as defined by Adam Smith, where I take care of myself, but within reason and with an eye for the common good. It's not that much more complicated than what we do, mm-hmm. right? Those are the people who are going to do this technology, right? The guys who make games the way that I want to make games, those are the folks who are going to be, you know, and I say guys just because I'm from Hawaii and we say guys to mean guys and girls. Obviously, girls are just as important in all of this. But I mean, people who are interested in making content that is actually going to do something for us and not just make some people wealthy. Mm-hmm. And so by kind of disrupting the way that information is delivered, because that's what this is, it's all information, it also gives us the opportunity to kind of reset the content of things and start creating things that are actually fun. Don't get me wrong, the world's not going to get more boring. It's going to be just as awesome as it always was. But on the back end of things, we're just going to be a little bit smarter about how we do things, right? No longer do we make food that is merely delicious. We make food that is delicious and good for you. No longer do we make software that is merely cool. It is cool, and it also solves real problems. And no longer do we make video games and entertainment that makes you choose between fun or educational, but where fun and educational is the same thing. And I think where we're heading ultimately is a convergence of apps, drugs, and rock and roll.
Right on, man. Great talking to you as always, Mike.
And, always a pleasure talking as well.
Right on, dude. We'll talk to you soon.
Cheers.